Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Dan Young on behalf of the appellant Michon Rhodes, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes, all right. Why don't you have one second, allow opposing counsel to have a seat here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, appreciate that. Appellant may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is about whether a lawyer exploiting a trusting person's trust has a remedy under the Washington Consumer Protection Act. And as you know, the trial court dismissed the CPA claim before trial. The other claim went to trial. And so the five elements of a Consumer Protection Act are well laid out, Hangman Ridge and all the progeny from there. And the trial court never did say which or more of the elements weren't satisfied, so I kind of went through all five of them. I think the first one, unfair and deceptive act or practice, I think we have a number of those here where the attorney involved falsely promised expert services which he didn't have available to her. And these are primarily accounting services. And quoting from her website and what she told my client in person, she stated that she had bookkeepers, accountants, reporting analysts, CPAs, tax attorneys, and a network of respected CFOs to provide business operators comprehensive support. And the benefit of that was, she said, that the client could receive skilled financial and accounting employees without incurring the high costs associated with employing these experts full-time. So she had a bevy of all these experts that would bring to bear all their financial expertise and provide that to the client.
May I ask you about the consumer protection theory? Was it that she was acting, was it the entrepreneurial capacity as an attorney or as an accountant? I mean, because her status, I mean, one could argue her status changed over the course of her relationship with this business. I just wondered what the theory was about why it fit within the consumer protection statute.
Well, it was actually both, Your Honor, because she actually did both. She was hired on as the general counsel and as the CFO, so she wore both hats. But as far as the falsely promising what she didn't deliver, that was mostly in the accounting arena.
She is an attorney, but is she also a CPA?
No, she is, to my knowledge, she is not a CPA. She is an attorney and has an LLM in tax.
What does the record show in terms of who she actually had as available professionals? I mean, there's the sister and the husband, and is there anybody else?
There's no record that she had anybody else. And that's exactly the problem, because she hired her sister, who is a cosmetologist, with no accounting background, and her husband had no accounting background. He was an IT person, really. So she put those people on instead of the promised experts and CFOs and all these other sorts of people that she claimed that she had, and she didn't deliver on any of that stuff. She didn't provide even the most rudimentary analysis of cash flow or profit and loss or any of that kind of stuff. And that's exactly why my client hired her, because my client didn't have the knowledge. She was a small business person that worked her way up and didn't have any of that accounting background. She had an accountant, but that accountant left about a year earlier. And so my client desperately needed this kind of expert accounting advice. And she thought she was getting it, but she didn't.
Now, there was some kind of a red door business storefront or something like that, and what does the record show about that?
The red door was another place, another small business that the attorney worked for. I think she was working there while she was going to law school. But she also worked there and did some kind of accounting for them as well. That part of it wasn't really developed in the record very much. There was not very much testimony.
What is there in the record with respect to other people who were her clients? I'm talking about Ms. Rain's clients.
The primary one that we are relying on is there's the declaration from Kyle Deuce, D-U-C-E, and he was a small business owner that hired Ms. Rain's to do work. She did a similar sort of thing with him. She sent him a great big bill. He said it was overbilled. She didn't provide the expert services that he was looking for. Then she...
There's not too much to that affidavit, though, really, is there? I mean, he's very conclusory. We don't know anything about what he's doing.
It is somewhat conclusory. There are some facts mentioned in there, however, but I think there's enough to raise a factual issue, and that's all that we have to do on summary judgment, is raise a factual issue from which a reasonable juror could conclude that there's a similar sort of thing going on. And she did get...
Do you have to prove that under the current state of the law that there is another client who is similarly situated and similarly deceived in order to prove the public interest in...
No, I do not think that we do. And I think particularly under the recent amendment to the Consumer Protection Act, that's RCW 19.86.0933, that sets forth a new test that's different from the Hangman Ridge test. And
when that amendment passed?
I believe it was about 4 years ago, something like that. And there are very few cases mentioning it even. There are a couple that I mentioned in my brief, but they don't really address the impact of it. But I think it has a huge impact. It really changes the nature of the public interest requirement. It says you can satisfy the public interest requirement one of three ways. Either the unfair deceptive conduct injured other people, and we submit that Kyle Deuce was one of those people injured, or had the capacity to injure other persons. And certainly there was the capacity because the attorney advertised on the web. She got a referral from the Small Business Administration. She made statements to people. So it certainly had the capacity. Or the third one has the capacity to injure other persons. Well, she's engaging in the same kind of conduct. These kinds of false statements and misrepresentation of your capabilities and the financial services, the expert financial services you will provide, certainly has the capacity to injure other persons. So I don't think the test...
Why do you think the legislature adopted that amendment? Do you have any theories about that? I mean, responding to some perceived lack in the
I tried to find some kind of legislative history on that, and I didn't find anything that was satisfying as to why they did it. My conclusion is that they were trying to liberalize the test and make it more correspond to what might be happening out there in the real world. It was, I mean, as we know, the...
Is it your understanding that under the Hangman Ridge test, before amendment, that public interest needs something else to prove it? Something besides just the conduct of the defendant?
Well,
some other damaged person?
I don't think it necessarily does, because in Hangman Ridge, they distinguish between consumer transactions and private transactions. And
now you're eating into your rebuttal time.
Oh.
You'd like to.
Oh, well, let me just that's fine. I'll accept that penalty or whatever. I'll answer the question. Because they set forth a four-part test for a private transaction. It had to be in the course of business, advertising to the public, active solicitation of the plaintiff, and unequal bargaining positions. And so this could actually, and I think it does, meet that four-part test of Hangman Ridge. That would be a sufficient basis to find public interest here, as well as the new statute. I think either one independently would be satisfied.
You'll have 2 minutes on the rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May I please the court, for the respondents' reins, I'm Greg Miller, not Ken Masters, as the brief said. I'm doing what I can with his very good brief. It's a pleasure to argue from one of his briefs for a change. Going to what the test is, first, I think we have to remember what the context of this case is. And this is a case alleging attorney violation of the CPA. And there are special rules for that.
Well, over a two-week period, and then the relationship lasted much longer when she went in-house.
And it changed. Because, remember, under that fee agreement, she was hired, and there is a request for admission, which they admitted. She was hired to help liquidate. And in the course of that 2 weeks, it changed. And so she then went in-house. The idea in the summer of 2011 was this company was in extremis, and it was going to be put to a merciful end, shall we say, through bankruptcy or whatever other mechanisms. So Ms. Raines came in with the expertise that she did have and went through, did an analysis, and they decided, no, maybe we can save this. And they did. It didn't close until April of 2013.
Just a little bit, what were Ms. Raines' credentials and what experience did she have as revealed by the record?
Well, that would go to, she had a JD and an LLM in tax. She was not soliciting Ms. Rhodes. Ms. Rhodes found her by a referral from the Small Business Administration. And she met with her before she ever looked at any ad. If you look at her declarations carefully, you'll see that she says, I was really impressed with her in person, and she convinced me that she could really help do what I need to do. But the fee agreement is very clear. It's liquidate. Be done with it.
But to return to my question, I mean, it is a little troubling that the advertising talks about all this great, all the great resources and availability of professionals who are going to help do this, and yet there just isn't much there, that, as revealed by the record. I mean, she hires her husband and her
That's all after she goes in-house.
Sister.
Sure.
And I'm not sure that there's anything to reveal that what other clients she had that she did important things for.
I think one of the things that the response brief does very well is to lay out these distinct areas that you have to look at. You have the two-week period where it's Raines legal.
I realize it does that, but I don't think that responds to my question. I'm asking what the record actually shows in terms of anything that Emily Sharp Raines actually did for people that was helpful, or what professionals she actually did have working for her.
I don't think that's material, and here's why. Once she went and became an employee, and she was hired as an employee by Ms. Rhodes, Ms. Rhodes was responsible for doing her own due diligence and then supervising or whatever else she would do with an employee. And if you were to say that what Ms. Raines did or didn't do, maybe with a puffed up resume, when she's in-house and doesn't perform, and is being accused of things that, in short, are dismissed. No, you can't talk about how good a job the lawyer did. That's malpractice or that's negligence. That's not what we're talking about. But once she's inside and it's hired, she's on a different role. She's not the outside lawyer in the commercial world. She's not involved in it. So you can't meet the Hangman Ridge test. Once she's inside, she's closed her law practice. Where is the repetition? Where is the future harm? The CPA is designed to protect consumers and future consumers, and the whole purpose of the private action is to prevent future problems. You don't have a prior example. Mr. Deuce is a financial services situation, not legal services.
Well, there's a representation here that there's a firm, whether it has lawyers or not, it's got a lot of accounting expertise, and it's really just ideally designed to help people who are struggling with potential bankruptcy to get their taxes in order, to make payments promptly, to wind everything up, and it's going to really do a great job of this. It seems to me that since that didn't happen, or allegedly didn't happen, with respect to Ms. Rhodes, that it potentially could happen with someone else. Why would that statement be wrong?
Well, it would be wrong for two reasons. Number one, she was only hired, given all those ads. Let's assume all the ads, and let's assume that those were looked at. She wasn't hired to do that and come and straighten out the company financially. She was hired as a law firm to liquidate. In the course of that work, as they got to know each other and as she got a chance to look and see how the business was operating, they decided to take a different course, and she went inside. Now she's not in a commercial operation. She's not got other clients who may be coming to her or who she may be advertising towards. She's shutting down her law practice and she's inside. And to the extent that she's not performing as she claimed she was going to, she's like any other employee, says, I'll get you the report next week. I'll get you the pre-hearing early. It doesn't show up. Well, you have to take that up with your law clerk. That was what they had to do inside once she was inside. She's not involved in the entrepreneurial aspect of law at that point.
What happened to that whole firm that she had that was operating out of the Red Door or whatever, all of these professionals?
It's my understanding from what I've read of the record in the last 2 weeks, Your Honor, that it closed. And I will be happy to provide supplemental information if I can find it. But that's, having gone through the record the last 2 weeks, that's my understanding. That was closed. It closed down. So she's not practicing any further.
About the 2 weeks that she functioned as an attorney, there's an allegation of bill padding.
Correct.
To come under Short versus Demopoulos. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding of the record, is that she asked for a $15,000 retainer, which was paid, and the client did not receive a bill showing how that $15,000 was allocated to work, and in fact did not get a bill at all until after the lawsuit was instigated. And then in discovery, this bill emerged that showed that all the $15,000 had been discharged, or whatever you call it, had been absorbed by the defendant.
There is a declaration.
Isn't that kind of a why does that practice not come under the Consumer Protection Act? I mean, normally, if you're a lawyer, you bill people on a timely basis.
Correct. And there is a declaration in the file, I believe it's from Michael Raines, indicating that he hand-delivered that to Ms. Rhodes in July of 2011.
Yeah, but
so that would have been timely delivered.
If one believed him, but isn't there controverting evidence?
There is a that may be a question of fact, but it also becomes a one-off. So you have a question, which I think Short talks about practice, whether this is a genuine practice. And if you look at the Cronenberg case, which you sat on, Your Honor, a number of years ago, Cotton v. Cronenberg, you're familiar with that. One of the issues in that case was whether they could look at the WSBA discipline files of complaints about Mr. Cronenberg's financial dealings, his fee agreements with his clients. And that was relevant to determine whether there was the kind of impact there. We're not going to have, can you imagine having every dispute over a fee turn into a CPA claim?
I certainly can, and that's why I'm asking the questions, but it does not seem to me that this is normally, that this has certain facets to it that are different from what one normally gets involved with in a client fee dispute.
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor.
I want to go back to that. So 2 weeks she was an attorney giving legal advice.
Correct.
Then her status changed. But wasn't one of the reasons that her status changed was to take advantage of her expertise as an attorney, as someone with this tax background? I mean, how is that change in status really alter the plaintiff's theory here, which, if I understand it correctly, is that it was kind of a scheme on her part to defraud the company?
Well, let's say when, Mr. Bill Newcomb is doing some work for Bill Gates, outside counsel, and convinces him that he can really help him run the company well if he goes in-house. And he goes in-house, and let's just pretend, we'll change the facts a little bit, that he was the one who made the mistakes that generated the antitrust litigation. Okay, big problem for the company. They didn't want to have anything like that. But he has gone in saying, I'm going to be able to keep you out of all this mess. Would he be subject to a CPA claim because he'd made representations and he went inside and he tried to fulfill those his work as an employee? I don't think so. That would dramatically change employment law. Not just what we do with attorneys and what kind of disputes go on with attorneys. It would change employment law as a whole.
Or another, he had just gotten out of law school and yet managed to convince Bill Gates that he had superior expertise that came from years of experience and being surrounded by immensely competent professionals. I don't think that would have happened, actually. But
no, I would agree here.
So I don't quite think that the defendant here is in the same category as Bill Newcomb.
No, but I think you have to think more broadly in terms of what are the implications for this case. And if you really have what amounts to a one-off and a fee dispute between an attorney and a client, and then the attorney goes in-house and acts as an employee, and they're unhappy with the performance, I don't think that's a CPA claim. The last point I would like to make before asking you to affirm, of course, is that for all the complaints that were made, the company was supposed to be dead and buried by the end of the summer of 2011. It wasn't. It went on for a year and a half. They made money. They were able to survive, and they had a chance to move. So whatever may have been the back and forth about who was more at fault for whether it succeeded or not, and you've got plenty of finger pointing here, and the jury sorted that out, it's not a CPA claim. It's an employment issue by the time she comes in-house.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Counsel, I let the respondent go on a little bit, so I'm going to give you back a minute of your time.
Okay? Thank you, Your Honor.
So 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, the one fallacy in the attorney's argument is there's he has not cited any authority in his brief or anyplace else about why the employee status makes any real difference here. If part of the scheme was to get employed, to get in, to worm her way into the business so she could extract money, then that, because she became an employee later on, would not have any effect on the scheme, seems to me. It would be part of it. Plus, there was no evidence as to when these particular periods of time took place. She was an attorney under that $15,000 retainer for a few weeks. Then she was hired as an independent contractor for 6 months. She didn't become an employee until the early part of 2012, after she had been working there for 6 months, because they didn't withhold Social Security and they didn't withhold income taxes. And she's the CFO. She ought to know how to do it right. If she's an employee, they should be withholding Social Security taxes and income taxes. And so that's
in the record. I missed that.
It is in the record, Your Honor. I cited to the places that said that. And so she didn't establish when she became an employee, when she was an independent contractor, what her exact role was. And there's evidence that she didn't close her law practice. I cited a number in footnotes, particularly letters that she wrote on her attorney letterhead after she was working with my client, with that small business, a number of them for months after she was there. So the statement that she closed her law business is not true. Or it certainly can be contested with the letters that she wrote on her firm letterhead.
So your position is there are material issues of fact about what her status was throughout?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
so you don't see this clear demarcation between acting as an attorney and then moving in-house?
No, it kind of merged, because originally my client was planning to sell the business or considering all of her options. They went to a bankruptcy attorney to talk about that, and because she had this big lien from the Department of Revenue for the taxes that weren't paid, and they grabbed it out of her account and so on, and she wanted expert advice. So that's why she went to Emily Raines. And she looked at the website. Sure, she met her first, but then she went and looked at the website to see what was there and saw all these great things that were confirmed by what she said. She got the referral from the Small Business Administration, and these are referring people like this. They must be good. And so she hired her to do those things, and actually she hired her personally. There's no mention of the corporation on that contract, which is interesting. So my client thought, well, she's working for me. She's my attorney. She's helping me try to solve this problem. Then Ms. Raines convinced my client, well, do you have any money? Maybe we could save this business. My client put in $65,000 of her own savings. She went to her life savings and said, well, yeah, we can try to save the company. Ms. Raines said, yeah, I think it could be saved. She put in the money, and, you know, there it went from there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.